Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, the show about the outdoors and America's public lands. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver. This week, uranium in the Four Corners region. What's the real story along the Grand Canyon and in Bears Ears? We'll talk to the experts from the Grand Canyon Trust. Plus, the death of Wyatt Earp this week in Western history. But first, we've got a whole lot of news to catch you up on in the new year. I try to keep these news updates to just a couple of minutes, but there is so much to cover that honestly, we could do an entire episode just on everything that happened on our public lands between our last episode and today. If you like that idea, let me know, and at some point we will do just a news update episode, podcast@westernpriorities.org. Also, let me know if you think that's an awful idea and we should just stick to the interviews. In the meantime, I'll keep this as short as possible. You probably saw the stories this week about Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke giving a political favor to Florida Governor Rick Scott, taking Florida out of the mix for a potentially massive expansion of offshore oil drilling. It's hard to overstate how badly Zinke stepped in it here. He managed to upset Republican and Democratic governors on both coasts, Republicans in Congress, and his allies in the oil industry, all in the period of about 24 hours. So now Zinke is basically trying to walk away from all of that because that Florida announcement that he made over Twitter could end up getting used against him in court if he keeps trying to open up drilling offshore in other states. It's just a mess. Let's back up a couple of weeks, though. There's a tradition in politics known as the Friday news dump. It was immortalized in an episode of The West Wing called Take Out the Trash Day 18 years ago. Basically, if you've got some bad news you have to announce, but you don't want it to get attention, you release it late on a Friday when most reporters and editors have gone home for the weekend. The news makes it into late Friday newscasts and Saturday newspapers, which no one watches or reads. And if you've got something you really want to bury, you release it on the Friday before Christmas or in between Christmas and New Year's. Folks, Secretary Zinke took the Friday news dump to unbelievable heights at the end of 2017. Now, it's my job to follow this stuff, and even I had trouble keeping track as it all came down. We counted up 11 pieces of trash over the holidays. I put them all in a blog post that links in the show notes, but just to give you a sense of what's in there. Zinke repealed fracking regulations that protected public lands. He stopped rules that were supposed to prevent another Deepwater Horizon disaster. He put oil drilling ahead of sage-grouse protection. He resurrected copper and nickel mining along Minnesota's boundary waters. He got caught using wildfire preparedness funds to take a helicopter flight that had nothing to do with wildfires. The list goes on from there. And then to top it all off, Secretary Zinke patted himself on the back by claiming his conservation legacy is already, quote, second only to Teddy Roosevelt. Seriously! And if that wasn't bad enough, in that same press release, Zinke promised us that 2017 was, quote, just the tip of the iceberg. A couple of other notes real quick. Outlaw rancher Cliven Bundy walked free this week because the prosecution bungled his case so badly, the judge dismissed the charges with prejudice. No chance of another trial. Now, here's the thing. While Bundy is busy claiming victory, it's important to remember that he did not win this case on the merits. He wasn't acquitted by a jury of his peers. He got off because prosecutors screwed up big time by not handing over all their evidence to the defense. A lot of folks are calling for an investigation into what went wrong at the Justice Department. That's great. But the ball is really now in Ryan Zinke's court. Cliven Bundy owes you and me over $1 million in fees and fines for letting his cows run feral on your public land. Zinke is promising to be a, quote, good neighbor to the Bundys, which, considering Cliven still doesn't even recognize the U.S. government as existing, sure makes it sound like the secretary plans to be more of a doormat than a neighbor. Uranium has been in the news lately, largely because of a company called Energy Fuels Resources that owns a uranium mine and mill on the edges of Bears Ears National Monument. Now, we're talking about the original boundaries, which the Obama administration drew specifically to keep that mine and mill outside of the monument. Despite that, Energy Fuels lobbied strongly for President Trump to shrink or even erase the monument, sending two letters urging Secretary Zinke to take a hard stand against the monument.
But the uranium story in the Four Corners region is far bigger than that. Joining us on the line to help us understand what's going on here, Amber Raimondo and Roger Clark, both with the Grand Canyon Trust. Thank to both of you for joining the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
So let's back up. How much uranium is there in the Four Corners region overall? I mean, how big a resource is this?
Yeah, well, relatively speaking, not much. It's actually a complicated question and with a complicated answer. But very simply, compared to other countries, the United States ranks 14th in national uranium reserves. So this isn't even talking about the Colorado Plateau alone, but across the entire country, we don't rank very high. We have about 1% of what are known global reserves, whereas countries like Australia have 29%, Canada has 9%. The other kind of longer answer to that question is that the amount of reserves that we have are dependent upon the price of uranium. And so the higher the price, the more economically feasible it is to mine, and so the larger the reserve. Right now, the price of uranium is really low. On January 1st, it was like $23.75 per pound. So at the end of 2016, the Energy Information Administration had estimated that the entire United States uranium reserves at an estimated price of about $30 a pound, so more than it is now, are something like 60 million pounds of uranium oxide, which is basically enough to fulfill the United States nuclear reactor needs for approximately 14 months.
So for all of President Trump and Secretary Zinke's talk of energy dominance, there is no scenario whatever in which the U.S. becomes completely self-sufficient when it comes to uranium needs, is what you're saying.
Right, for not longer than 14 months at our current demand, yeah.
So let's talk about the history of uranium mining in northern Arizona. This is, relatively speaking, as far as the atomic age goes, a relatively new development.
Yeah. So the earliest I've been able to find of mining on the Colorado Plateau took place in the 1890s, but that was primarily a byproduct of vanadium mining. Uranium mining for the sake of uranium started to pick up in the 1950s, like you mentioned. And the Four Corners states were a big part of that. So that's really when it all started, and it kind of continued until, the 1970s is when the AEC stopped providing incentives for operators to continue mining. And so it started to decline there. And then in the 1980s, the price of uranium tanked, and we have kind of the same situation. We're seeing the same situation today, where not a lot of mines are operating.
So you mentioned already the Canyon Mine, and that is the current uranium mine that's near the canyon. It's about 6 miles away, and to me that might sound like a kind of far distance. Either Amber or Roger, how does a 6 mile distance to the canyon actually pose a threat to the Colorado River?
Beneath the surface where the mining occurs is also abundant groundwater, and they're not necessarily mixed. And the distance to Grand Canyon via the points of contamination could be the linear distance from the mine to the Grand Canyon's entrance, which is 6 miles. But it could also be a longer path, or in some cases, a shorter path underground. And really what we need to think about, not so much as distance, but pathways. And you have to think of, particularly in limestone formations beneath the ground, a series of conduits which water flows. And that water flows in many, many different directions, all of it downhill. We know that for sure.
If I could add something to that, I think the Colorado River is, of course, of concern, but there are other water sources that are of concern as well. And in particular, we often talk about at the Trust, the Havasupai people, and the fact that their water source is their only water source. Their village, Supai Village, is very remote. They live 10 miles into this side canyon off of the Grand Canyon. And the only way to get to their village is by helicopter, by hiking, or by riding a mule. And so really, if their water source is contaminated, that's all that they have. And not only do they use it for drinking, but it's a source of their identity. So, I mean, the Havasupai people, their name means people of the blue-green water, which is named after the blue-green water that flows from the Redwell Moab Aquifer, which directly underlies the canyon mine. And as Roger was mentioning, distance isn't really, it's not a singular factor to be considered. It could be a fracture or a fault that we don't know about, or perhaps that we do find out we know about, that could lead to contamination of those sources of water as well.
So that was my next question. One of the things I've learned here at CWP when it comes to mining contamination and cleanup, to borrow a phrase from Donald Rumsfeld, you've got your known unknowns and your unknown unknowns. What do we know about contamination in the area, and what do we not even know yet, either because it hasn't been studied or there is no way to study it or learn it until it's too late?
One of the problems that we're running into is that the withdrawal was put in place in 2012 with the presumption that the USGS would have the time and the money to embark on a number of different scientific studies to be able to at least get an idea of what groundwater flow and speed looks like in the region. Unfortunately, after the withdrawal was put in place, the USGS hasn't seen the funding that they needed, significantly less, actually. And so even being able to know, for instance, the direction of groundwater flow around Canyon Mine is a big undertaking, because they were only able to scrape together the money to drill one monitoring well, as opposed to the three that they needed. So groundwater flow is a big unknown. The geology is a big unknown in terms of the faults and fractures. A lot of this information is stuff that we would need a lot of time to figure out and a lot of money to figure out. And so far, we just haven't been able to dig into that as much as we would have hoped.
The environmental impact statement, record of decision, said that from what little data we do have, we know that, or we think the risk is relatively small of contamination. But we also know that when contamination occurs, it's nearly impossible to change or reverse or remediate. So it's kind of like one of these black swan events, like they often refer to, say, with deep water horizon, low likelihood of an accident, but high probability if an accident occurs, you're screwed. And so based on that, the Department of Interior and the Secretary of Interior said, let's err on the side of caution and gather another 20 years of data while allowing Canyon Mine and other mines that are already permitted to go forward, so we can gather data before, during, and after and get a better handle on what we know. The other big unknown is the pathways of how radioactive or radionuclides and byproducts of mining uranium enter into the biota, into the plants and animals, into the insects, the birds, bats that swarm around and fly around the holding water at the mine site, which is not covered. We're not entirely sure about contamination of foods. For example, when Navajo sheep eat contaminated grass and drink water that's contaminated, and then people eat the sheep, what happens there? So there's a lot of unknowns about the pathways of contamination and effects on particularly human populations, but on the entire ecosystem. And those effects sometimes don't show up for a generation or two. So it's very difficult to track. And then from what we do know on the Navajo reservation, that many of those effects were felt by the miners within 10, 15 years of their mining activity. And it was showing up with miners' families when they'd go home and take off their dusty clothes, and the dust would get into the house, and it was like breathing secondhand smoke. The slow contamination through drinking water that has radionuclides in it is only now being understood and studied in some detail. But there are over 500 mine sites that have been unreclaimed that are unhealthy for the people living around those mines and even downstream from those mines where the ore, the uranium ore, is contaminating the soil, the air, and the water around it.
So that's the legacy of the first 50-odd years of uranium mining. What's the status right now? Is the Canyon mine currently producing or not because prices are so low?
It's not currently producing. They dug their main mine shaft last year, and the date of ore production keeps getting pushed back. It was when I first came on, I think it was supposed to be in early or mid 2017, and now it still hasn't happened, obviously, and we're looking at into next year potentially.
So that brings us into the Obama administration, and I know President Obama imposed a 20-year moratorium on new mining claims in the area, and that's now in question. What's the status of what the Trump administration is doing right now as far as new mining claims?
Well, the Trump administration's intentions are not eminently clear, but we know, obviously, from their behavior from their behavior elsewhere, their anti-environment, anti-public lands attitude, that it's very likely that this withdrawal could be under threat. And then in 2017, three specific things happened that give us even greater concern that the mineral withdrawal, or the mining ban, whatever you want to call it, is at risk. And that the first thing that came about was that in March of 2017, Trump signed an Executive Order 13783, which was intended to promote domestic energy independence. And that executive order led to a November USDA recommendation that the Grand Canyon mining ban be reviewed as a potential option for lessening the burden on domestic energy development. We still haven't seen anything final on that. We don't know if the administration has accepted or plans to accept that recommendation, but that's out there on top of, you know, the National Mining Association and other industry supporters calling for the withdrawal to be lifted. And then in December, there was a congressional hearing that looked at the burden that that mineral withdrawals place upon the United States and the country's ability to avoid dependence on foreign minerals. And the withdrawal came up in that as well. And finally, also in December, Trump signed another executive order, this time asking Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke to come up with a list of what are called critical minerals. And whatever is on that list ultimately, which we expect to see in February sometime, will result in a strategy later this year on how the United States can increase the extraction of whatever those minerals are. And so we'll be watching that closely because if uranium is on that list, then obviously that's another point of concern for us and for the mineral withdrawal.
So basically they're laying the groundwork potentially for resuming and adding more uranium mining near the canyon.
Yeah, we sort of look at this as the baby steps that they're taking to be able to remove the withdrawal. Yeah.
And the Obama withdrawal, that was on new mining claims. Now, with existing claims, could those still end up leading to new mines regardless? Or was the Obama withdrawal, did that really crack down on even opening up a new mine based on prior claims?
So if a claim that was in place prior to July 2009, which was when the area was segregated, it was when the withdrawal was first proposed. If a claim that was in place before then has what are called valid existing rights, they are allowed to continue their operations. So far, only one mine has been given officially that declaration by the U.S. Forest Service, and that's Canyon Mine. And so Canyon Mine is moving forward. There are others that could get that sort of determination, and those include, just to name a few, the Arizona One Mine and the EZ Complex, which I believe there are three claims in that area that could be developed. And so it's mostly prohibitive of mining development, but like you said, the mineral withdrawal could allow a handful of mines to go forward and has allowed one at least.
So beyond uranium, then, you've got this mining legacy dating back into the 19th century. We know that there are thousands of abandoned mines in the area. We've done some look, you know, estimating cleanup costs. We know there are hundreds of abandoned mines alone on the Navajo Reservation. What is the overall cleanup situation? And from your perspective, what should it be compared to what's happening right now with abandoned mines?
The hottest and most contaminated places are mill sites where they brought uranium ore together and concentrated into yellowcake. And several of those have been treated on the Navajo Reservation. Basically, they've hauled off as much of the surface contamination as they can. They've covered the contaminated area with another kind of rock to help absorb any contamination radiation coming off the site. And they're pumping the groundwater beneath those sites into lined ponds to evaporate water and collect the radioactive residue. And I don't know the exact numbers, but there's, in my mind, there's at least six reclaimed sites around on and around the Navajo Reservation. And then more recently, one of the more prominent sites is further to the north, just above the confluence of the Green and Colorado River north of Moab. And that Atlas mill site is one that's had highly contaminated radioactive waste and sludge in the floodplain in the Colorado River. And that's a Department of Energy commitment of now over $1 billion to remove that material. They built a railroad line just to collect the material and take it not that many miles away, but in a geological strata where it's less likely to contaminate the Colorado River. And that's really just the tip of the iceberg.
And I think just to add one piece to that, one of the problems that are one of the reasons for these problems are inadequate surety bonds. So in the case of mining or milling uranium, the company who's mining is supposed to put in place a surety bond, which acts as an insurance policy for the reclamation of that site should the company go bankrupt and leave the government to do the cleanup. But in a lot of cases, and it's not unique to uranium mining, this happens in oil and gas drilling as well and coal mining. But in most cases, the surety bonds are far inadequate of what is required to actually do the cleanup. And so, and when you think about it, a lot of the times that a mine like a uranium mine closes down is because the economics no longer make sense. And so if you wait that long before you close down, are you going to have money in your pocket to do the cleanup? Probably not. A lot of companies end up filing bankruptcy, and then the government is left to do the cleanup with either no or an inadequate surety bond.
Is there any safe way to mine uranium in the Four Corners region? Could these companies take sufficient precautions and provide for cleanup costs in a way that would satisfy the trust and, as far as you know, the tribes?
You know, that's a question that we would all love to have the answer to. but that's exactly the problem. And that's why the withdrawal around the Grand Canyon, one big reason why the withdrawal around the Grand Canyon was put in place, because we don't know if mining can be done safely. But one thing we do know is that there can be a lot of risk that is associated with uranium mining. And so if we know that in the past we've seen big consequences from mining of uranium, and we have companies that are saying, oh, but our processes are different and regulations are better, it's not going to be the same. Well, the only way that we know if their practices are any safer is by trial and error. If they mine the way that they're now mining and then waiting to see if contamination shows up. But unfortunately, contamination can show up immediately or it can show up in decades down the road. And so we don't really have a great understanding of whether or not their claims of having processes that are now safe are accurate. And do we really want the Grand Canyon to be the guinea pig for that? And the people who rely on the Grand Canyon to be the guinea pig for that? I don't think so.
I'd like to add that it, really the situation is such that the proponents, the mining industry that wants to get access to these minerals, has really put the burden of proof on the agencies and on the public to say, well, you need to prove that our activity is contaminating something. And until you do that, we should be able to go forward and mine. In the public interest and applying the precautionary principle, it would make entirely more sense to say the burden of proof needs to be on the proponents, the uranium industry, to demonstrate that it doesn't contaminate. And based on the evidence we have right now, everywhere there's been mining and milling, there's contamination. So that's a 100% finding of contamination, and they need to be able to demonstrate that they can do it without contaminating. The other problem is, of course, regulatory agencies, the state and federal agencies, have not required adequate monitoring of, say, groundwater. There's no groundwater monitoring required under Canyon Mine. That even if there is contamination, we won't know it. So it's made it easy for the uranium industry to argue that there's no evidence of contamination, which is patently false.
For folks who are listening to this right now and they want to take action, what is the best way for them to both stay informed over the next year, because it sounds like it's going to be an important one, and more importantly, what's the best way for them to get involved in this?
Yeah, they can go to GrandCanyonTrust.org/uranium, and they can sign up for our newsletter. We also have there a link to sign the petition in support of the mineral withdrawal. That petition will be sent to Secretary Zinke and Arizona's congressional representatives. They can sign up with our volunteer program. Our volunteer program runs several projects throughout the year. Sometimes they're directly related to uranium mining and sometimes not. But they're also hosting now an ability to screen our new uranium film called Too Precious to Mine for your friends. It's a 9-minute film. And if you'd like to host a screening party, they can get in touch with our volunteer program and get the package to do that. They could also share the 3-minute version of that film on their social media and help us drive attention to this issue. And I think lastly, they could write to Secretary Zinke and tell him how important this withdrawal is and to support it remaining intact and in place.
And we will put links to all of that in the show notes here. Amber Raimondo is the Energy Program Director. Roger Clark is the Grand Canyon Program Director, both with the Grand Canyon Trust. Thank you both so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
I want to bring in our deputy director from the Center for Western Priorities, Greg Zimmerman. Greg's been following a lot of the uranium debate around Bears Ears National Monument just to the north of the canyon in southeast Utah. And Greg, you've been following Energy Fuels Resources and what they wanted out of the monument originally, and then when they realized there was an opportunity maybe to change the monument. What's the story there?
Yeah, so we knew that Energy Fuels had a stake in and around Bears Ears. Energy Fuels Resources operates a mine just outside of the boundaries of Bears Ears National Monument called the Daneros Mine. It's actually not currently in production, but had been in production as recently as 2012. And Energy Fuels has intentions to bring it back into production when the price of uranium goes back up. And they also operate the White Mesa Mill, which is actually the only active uranium mill inside the United States. So we knew that Energy Fuels had an active stake in Bears Ears. And we also knew that the Obama administration consulted with Energy Fuels Resources when they were taking under consideration the tribe's proposal to protect Bears Ears as a national monument. And ultimately, the Obama administration did provide some carve-outs to give Energy Fuels Resources essentially what it wanted to maintain its stake outside of the monument.
And at the end of the day, what did they want from the Trump administration and from Secretary Zinke? What did they ask for?
All right. So, we fast forward here, 6-8 months after the National Monument was initially protected, and we've learned a lot more about what Energy Fuels Resources wanted and what they were expecting to get from the Trump administration. So our first sort of data point was when we learned that Energy Fuels had hired a high-powered lobbyist called Fagri BD to lobby on its behalf. Now, Energy Fuels doesn't have a history of lobbying Congress or administrations. And so it was pretty interesting that they brought on this lobbyist beginning in 2017. And the primary lobbyist on their contract was a guy by the name of Andy Wheeler. And Andy Wheeler is a very prominent individual who's actually been nominated to be the number two at the EPA under Scott Pruitt. But prior to being nominated for this position, he was working on behalf of Energy Fuels Resources to advocate its interests with the Trump administration. The second data point that we got to sort of educate us on what Energy Fuels Resources was up to here was when we came across their comments, their public comments that they submitted to Secretary Zinke and the Interior Department during the review of the National Monuments. In their comments, they are very explicit and clear about what their interest is in the National Monument. They say that there are many known uranium and vanadium deposits inside the newly created Bears Ears National Monument, and they request that DOI reduce the size of Bears Ears, quote, only to those specific areas or sites, if any, deemed to need additional protection beyond what is already available to federal land management agencies. So what they're saying here is, I mean, it's not a dog whistle. It's like loud and clear with, you know, giant orange flags that they want the administration to eliminate as much of Bears Ears as possible.
But then after that, we saw a story from the Washington Post that basically laid this out, and they responded with an op-ed that was this basically this pay no attention to the man behind the curtain defense, trying to pretend those letters never happened?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. They're trying to have their cake and eat it, too. They're trying to think that the American public isn't going to pay attention to what they were saying behind closed doors. What they wanted when they talked to the administration, and it's become clear in these comments, is for the administration to eliminate Bears Ears. And that's ultimately what they got. Now, they've had some terrible press because the American public isn't particularly happy that a uranium company has the ear of an administration, and the administration is ignoring the interests of the five tribal nations who've worked tirelessly to protect this place, ignoring the interests of communities and the American public in favor of this multinational uranium company.
And the last thing that they mentioned, which struck me as odd considering their public comments, was that they don't actually hold any more mining claims inside Bears Ears, either the Trump boundaries or the original Obama boundaries. I mean, does that actually hold water?
Well, that is up for debate still. By all appearances, according to BLM data, they do still hold a stake in and have mining claims inside of Bears Ears National Monument. Now, we know that the company has claimed that they have divested themselves of those claims to another uranium company. Even if they have, we know for a fact that in the deal where they divested themselves of at least a percentage of these claims, they also retained an ownership stake in that company and a board seat. So even if they're ultimately able to prove that they no longer have that this specific company, Energy Fuels Resources, no longer has the primary ownership stake in Bears Ears, they still have a critical ownership stake in this other company and a board seat and have a financial interest in what happens to the lands moving forward.
So the bottom line, if those claims, whether they technically own them or not, if those claims were to start producing uranium, then Energy Fuels would make significant money off those claims.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, it's worth noting that that the CEO at Energy Fuels, this guy named Mr. Goranson, also holds a board seat at this other company. So it's not like there's this barrier between the two companies. They're very much integrated and involved in each other's business. And this particular CEO also happened to be the fellow who visited the Interior Department last summer and advocated on behalf of Energy Fuels interests and to remove protections of Bears Ears with high-level folks in the Trump administration.
All right, Greg Zimmerman, Deputy Director here with us at the Center for Western Priorities. Greg, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Aaron.
One final number to think about here. Amber and Roger talked about the risk of uranium contamination with the Canyon Mine being 6 miles from the South Rim. Well, across the West, according to the University of New Mexico, 600,000 Native Americans live within 6 miles of an abandoned hard rock mine. Let's wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. It was this week in 1911 when Teddy Roosevelt protected the Grand Canyon as a national monument. We talked about that a whole lot last year. Head back to episode 6 in your feed for the backstory. I'll just note this year that Grand Canyon National Monument, protected by Teddy Roosevelt, was more than 800,000 acres. So anytime you hear National Monument opponents claiming the Antiquities Act wasn't supposed to protect landscapes, remind them of that. 800,000 acres protected by the guy who signed the law, and the Supreme Court agreed with him a few years later. End of story. The Antiquities Act has always protected American landscapes. Also this week, legendary lawman Wyatt Earp died in 1929. It was nearly 50 years after that infamous shootout at the OK Corral in Tombstone, Arizona. What happened afterwards, though, is almost more interesting. Wyatt's brother Morgan was killed 3 months later, and a few days after that, one of the suspects, Frank Stillwell, was found dead in Tucson. Wyatt and his friend Doc Holliday were accused, accurately, it turns out, of murdering Stillwell. But Wyatt and Holliday fled, killing another man on the way who they thought had also been involved in his brother's death. And they got away with it. In the decades that followed, Wyatt Earp made his way up and down the West. He speculated in gold mines in Idaho, raised thoroughbreds in San Diego, he ran a saloon in San Francisco, and joined the gold rushes in both Alaska and Nevada. He eventually settled in Los Angeles, hoping to get famous from all his Western adventures. It never quite happened. He did become an unpaid advisor on Hollywood Westerns, but never really cashed in himself. When Wyatt Earp died, silent film star Tom Mix wept openly at the funeral. It wasn't until 2 years after his death that the first biography of Earp appeared. Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal, was more fiction than fact, but it was adapted into 3 movies and a TV series, finally giving Wyatt Earp the fame he so longed for in life. Lawman and murderer Wyatt Earp, who died this week in 1929. That's it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. Hey, a big shout out to the Hungry Yogis blog for including us on their list of 5 favorite outdoor podcasts. We are proud to be on such an esteemed list. A little housekeeping. I'm sure a number of you are planning to be in Denver later this month for the huge outdoor retailer Snow Show. Drop us a line if you are. Maybe we'll try to put together a little podcast meetup. podcast@westernpriorities.org. Also at the show, our executive director, Jen Rokla, will be on a lunchtime panel on Thursday, the 25th, along with the bipartisan polling team behind Colorado College's annual Conservation in the West poll. We've got a link to that in the show notes. Thanks again to our guests, Amber Raimondo and Roger Clark from the Grand Canyon Trust. On behalf of the entire Center for Western Priorities crew, I'm Aaron Weiss, and thanks for listening.